Welcome to the Evidence Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprint, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. This is your host, Don Nikoloff. I'm going to be with you for the next hour, an hour which actually started a bit late. We had trouble with getting a pizza to the studio, and we had an accident in the men's room. No, I'm just kidding. Sometimes we run a little bit behind schedule, and so we just have to bear with it and know that the show's going to go on as usual. So nice to have you here tonight. There's been quite a bit of activity on my website. I'm grateful for all the people that are passing the word around and letting us know what they think about some of the new pages that are up, and I just am grateful for all the nice compliments. Very few negative comments, I should say. There's no such thing as a negative compliment. I'll just say that we're going to keep adding some pictures to the chemtrails page. And that has to do with Ken Adachi's wonderful photography of some sylphs. We are finding countless pictures within these pictures. In fact, as he's enhancing some of them, so you, the listeners and the viewers of the chemtrail page on my website, can easily see what he's talked about and what he's described. We are finding that it's enhancing other images that we previously didn't even see. So it's just going to get more exciting as this goes along. I wonder how many thousands of pictures we're actually going to have. In any event, we're going to move along right now. This is the third night in a row that I've had this guest with me. He is an author. He is a metaphysical scientist and inventor of sorts. He is also a journalist, a very accomplished journalist, and he has a great website, one of the most popular websites in the world, educate-yourself.org, and his name is Ken Adachi. Ken, welcome to the show again tonight.
Thank you, Don. So nice to be back again.
Well, I'm happy to have you back. We spent two nights talking about chemtrails, and I'll give you one more shot if you want to say anything else, either about the pictures or, you know, whatever else is on your mind, before we go into the topic that we promised we were going to do last night.
Okay, well, I'll just mention that on the 28th, I took some pictures outside, starting in the morning and then in the afternoon and early evening, of chemtrails and sylphs, and it was a pretty active day for chemtrail spraying. We had quite a bit of activity. Starting in the morning, I first got out there around 9 o'clock, and they were laying them, but also sylphs were pretty busy, and what sylphs do is they transmute the chemtrails into a non-toxic substance, and then the residue of that transmutation, what I call transmuted clouds, builds up in the upper atmosphere. It has a very pebbly appearance to it, pebbly appearance. And then as the day progressed on, by late afternoon, early evening, those banks and banks of transmuted clouds seemed to have coalesced and formed into much larger cumulus clouds, very beautiful white-looking cumulus clouds. They were fairly substantial in size, and this was late afternoon, early evening. Now, so in addition to taking pictures of what looked like a fabulous a fabulous day transforming these noxious chemtrails into these what eventually wind up to be natural-looking clouds. The sylphs themselves had taken on different appearances, so I was photographing them, and around 6:30 or 7 in the evening, as the sun was going down, it was just above the horizon, there was a huge, what we're calling a sylph, directly over my house. I mean, it was just centered over my house, but it was big. I couldn't photograph it in one frame. I would have had to take many frames to get it all in. So I switched over to the video camera function on my digital camera. And a couple times I just scanned the entire circumference and interior portion of that sylph. And later that night I uploaded the photos. And we were talking on the phone during the interview, which we had the last night or two, and I began to notice a lot of very distinct-looking forms in the pictures. And so when they go to your page and they see the pictures of the chemtrails, they'll see conventional chemtrails, they'll see these banks of transmuted clouds that have this pebbly-type appearance, very high. And then they'll also see some still shots that were taken from this video that I made, which you're referring to as a film. And within that, I was able to take stills, capture frames, as I say, and we started to work on adjusting the color. We adjusted the tone. We could reverse the light and dark areas. There's a number of filters which we can put the image through in an attempt to try to draw more detail. And as we play with these various filters and adjustments that are possible with Photoshop, these images started to emerge with, you know, greater clarity and contrast. And we're finding a host of images. We're finding images that look like human faces. We're finding images that look like various types of animals. Some images look perhaps like aliens. It's just fascinating what's coming out of this. And of course, anybody who wants to do this can do it. You just get a digital camera and install Photoshop, and you'd be amazed. I'm being amazed at how many images are embedded within these sylphs, or what we're calling sylphs. How many various images are embedded? So you're able to spot them even before I do, Don. So you've been able to pick out a few that I didn't spot right off. But once you pointed them out to me, I went there. I cropped it, and then I, if necessary, enlarge the image somewhat, and then try to run it through various filters to see what emerges.
Yeah, you just for the sake of those people out there that hear the word Photoshop, when someone looks at a picture and it's got a paranormal anomaly in it, they tend to think that you have manipulated the photo to produce this, as someone would a graphic image for a movie, or to deceive someone. I want to stress on your behalf that you are just merely using the filters in Photoshop to change the appearance of the photo in terms of, as you explained, contrasting the light, putting filters that cut out some of the glare or reduce the white noise content of the photo, or, and I say white noise even though it's natural white light, nonetheless. When these images appear as starkly as some of them do, for instance, when you invert the contrast, like it's like looking at a negative in a sense.
Right.
It's amazing how much more clarity comes out. So we may be seeing something that's actually inside the cloud, rather than on the, let's say, the outer surface. But there's plenty to see as this is moving on the film. My eye catches these images. And when we pause the or the video, as you refer to it, as when we pause the video and still the frame, and then you capture that frame, you're merely cutting out a segment of the whole thing, and it's amazing what's in just one frame.
Yes.
Really amazing.
Yes. Yeah, that's that needs to be understood. I'm not an expert in the use of the computer, and nor am I an expert in Photoshop. It's I'm essentially an amateur in all areas when it comes to using computer. It's just kind of tech and play. But I found out a few years ago, thanks to a gal named, I think her name is Barbara Olson Krauss, if I recall. This gal has a fabulous website. I have it linked on my website. One of the uppermost links at the top pages brings it to her page. She has a website that's called, let me see if I can remember the name correctly. No, Oliwa. Is it Oliawa Press? She's been taking photographs that she finds off the internet of politicians, of clouds, and she's very skilled using Photoshop, and by enlarging the image and using various filters, she's been able to draw simply remarkable hidden details. She just does amazing stuff. There's a second woman I ought to mention, too, who's also very skilled at discovering, I'll use the word hidden images, at least it's hidden to the eye when first looking at the image. It's only through enlargement and changes in contrast, changes in color, saturation, hue, etc., that the image emerges. This gal's name is Jane Tripp, T-R-I-P-P. Now, I can't remember the name of her website, but she's contacted me a few times. I've seen her stuff. It's amazing. She has all kinds of elemental beings who appear in photographs for her. Mm. And it's something like you would see out of Star Wars. The way to find her is do a Google search under the name Jane Tripp, T-R-I-P-P. She has amazing photos. And she, too, when we talk a few times on the phone, discovers that there's images from entities that are probably in a slightly higher vibration than we are, that can be seen in clouds and smoke and various type of photographs, but they seem to be images within images.
Mm-hmm.
Because this gal keeps on enlarging, and she finds that there are images, and then when she enlarges the, let's say, the eye of a person that she's focused on, she finds another image within that. It's simply amazing what she's finding.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm doing here is fun and fascinating, but digital photography itself has a lot to do with the fact that we're able to capture now and see and bring out these so many of these, let's say, unusual phenomena with these digital photos.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm starting to see that in some of these enhancements that you're doing, the same thing. In fact, you emphasize the face in one, and then I sort of sent you a message back that not only was that face and the neck that you were referring to in the title of the photo
right
there, but the back of the head had this little being in it, and then the whole thing takes on the appearance of a crocodile. This is kind of interesting.
Right. It is very interesting, and the very last photo I sent you as we started the show, you've probably got it by now. There's an extremely faint face there. I actually have three slight variations. I just sent you one of the three. I probably
mm-hmm.
should send you the middle one next.
That's the woman's face from the cherub photo.
Correct. Right. Now, I didn't even see that. That particular shot in my original my original shot, just saw what I saw would look like a very thin horizontal band of what? Chemtrails? Silk? Wasn't sure, but it was just an odd-looking horizontal line against what seemed to be a blue sky background, slightly hazy. And then when we reversed the image, what started out to be just a faint horizontal line seemed to have wings to them. And then it was you who pointed out that there's... And then when I looked closer, I saw the what looked to me to be more like a water spot. And when I framed it and enlarged it and started to try to draw out the detail, sure enough, this is only one of the faces. I haven't even had the time to work on the others, but I'm just thrilled at what comes of this just by noodling around in with this Photoshop program.
Now, you know, the more of these that you actually film, the more work you're creating for all of us.
I know. But it's just a gas, though. It's simply
a
gas.
Oh, yeah. It's fantastic. Well, we can always pick this up another time.
Yeah, right. Sure, I know. We have other things we want to talk about today, which we've been postponing.
Now, I want to point something out, and I alluded to this on the TNT NewsHour yesterday. I did a sort of a rant and some news items on the president's speech, and I got to hear this Rose Garden interview he did with the media.
Okay.
And aside from him sounding rather inebriated or under the influence of some substance, I've never seen anyone in public act like this before. I mean, he was very disrespectful to the media, even though I don't have that much respect for the mainstream media. He seemed to be just full of glee that he could be as obnoxious as he wanted. And basically just take the microphone away from anyone who wanted to ask a sensitive question.
Mm.
Well, eventually a question came up regarding the oil crisis. And, of course, if we listen to what Lindsay Williams has said about the non-oil crisis for the past 25 or so years,
mm-hmm.
Written in his book and as well as on numerous interviews that he has done on the Patriot Network, and even here on Evident Footprints, he has flat out said that they're aiming to raise the price of gasoline to $5 a gallon sometime in 2008. And, of course, we're getting very close to that. And he's been saying this for 25 years.
Yep.
Isn't it synchronistic that it's happening just as he said it would? Now, that said, the president started this really incompetent ramble about the benefits of ethanol and corn, and I mean, it just didn't make any sense what he was saying. It was almost like I was watching Frank Calienda do an impersonation of him.
Yes.
And intentionally, you know, trying to be ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
I hope Frank gets to see that, because it'll make a great routine for him. But nonetheless, they were alluding to the fact that we are out of oil, and we know that that's a cover-up. The fact is that they control the oil, and they're going to charge what they want to charge for it, and they're going to nickel and dime us to death. And we have some solutions. And I know that you particularly wanted to discuss the issue of Brown's gas and how the concept is available to us. And it doesn't cost an arm and a leg. In fact, it would be worth any investment that would save us money on petroleum products.
Right.
And I was leading in, so you can take the driver's seat and sort of steer us down the path as to what Brown's gas is, what the concept is, and then, you know, let's have an exchange, because
okay.
I know some people who are also in that business too.
Okay. Yeah. What I wanted to do when we talked a few days ago is I says I wanted to spend some time on introducing the idea that there are solutions, inexpensive solutions to obtaining a fuel to run your car on. There are inexpensive solutions to obtaining food and to producing heat and electricity in your home. Now, what I'm going to bring up today is not something that I invented or I thought up. This information has been researched by many people over a long period of time. And tonight, due to the amount of time we have, it'll only be the briefest of instruction, but I want people to understand that alternative fuel techniques, technologies, have been suppressed for a long time, and they continue for most of the 20th century. We could have had unlimited free electricity beginning in 1903, thanks to Nikola Tesla. But that type of transmission of electricity through the air was called wireless transmission of electricity or radiant energy. We could have had it free in unlimited amounts, but the people like J.P. Morgan and other members of what we call the Illuminati, don't want people to have free anything, so they suppress that. Now, as early as let's go back to the 20s and 30s. There was a man in Canada named Charles Pogue. He developed a carburetor design that was funded by a Canadian entrepreneur who had some serious money, and he was able to get over 200 miles to a gallon. And what he did is developed a type of carburetor which vaporized the fuel to a much higher extent than it's done since that time. Number one. And number two, he treated the gasoline of that day. The gasoline of that day is not the same gasoline they make today, because today the gasoline is obtained through a process called catalytic cracking. Well, at that time, this was in the 20s and 30s, gasoline was obtained in a much simpler way. It was called Wells head gasoline, today we call this type of gasoline white gas. Now, Pogue developed a way in which he was able to vaporize and atomize the gas to a much finer degree, and also he was able to essentially crack it, as it were, from very long chain molecules to shorter chain molecules within the carburetor. And that's how he was able to get 200 miles to a gallon. Now, as all inventors, particularly of that era, they haven't got a clue about the suppressive intentions of the elites and the oligarchs of this country. So he patented it, and he thought the whole world would embrace him. My God, he's going to, even though gasoline, what could it have cost in the 1920s, early 30s? A nickel a gallon? I mean, had to be quite cheap. But he thought, but what happens, they set about, presumably agents of the oil company stole his carburetors. The man had a lot of trouble. He got totally, the backers that the entrepreneur who was funding Pogue were all threatened. They pulled their money out. This story of an inventor being bushwhacked and sandbagged from many quarters has repeated itself over and over and over again. So we move up to the 1970s. A guy named Stanley Meyer out of Ohio got concerned about the rising cost of gasoline due to the 73 oil embargo. He starts looking into producing a fuel, hydrogen, from water. And he continues to do it right into the 1990s, the late 1990s. And he was very successful at it. It took him a number of years to figure out to get the bugs out of his system, but he figured out a way to run an automobile or any other type of vehicle. It could have been a boat or a train, or using only water. Now, it's hard for a lot of people to conceive of the notion that water can be a fuel, because we have it in the common consciousness that water and gas don't go together, and that water would tend to inhibit combustion. But when water is treated in the right way, it can be a fuel, and it can be a very powerful fuel. Now, Stanley Myers was murdered. He was poisoned in March of, I think it was, let me get the date right, 1997, I believe. I have a videotape of him doing a workshop and a conference in Colorado in October of 1996, and he's talking about his system. And he built a plant, or I should say he got the funding to build a huge research development plant in Ohio. And he was at a lunchtime a dinner in which he was celebrating with officials from the UN, the new research facility, and the fruit juice that he was drinking was poison. And he died within a few minutes. He was able to stagger out to the parking lot. He stood up. He told the people next to him, "I've been poisoned." He runs out of the restaurant and just about made it to the parking lot, and he collapsed, and he died there. Of course, they never called it a suicide. They called it a aneurysm, but the man clearly was poisoned. So that sort of put a complete stop to Stanley Myers' work. Many other people now have worked on systems that use water in conjunction with gasoline to cause it to cause improved fuel mileage and improved burning efficiency. So you get less buildup of carbon and wear, and the engine can idle at a much lower speed and still continue to run. There was a Bulgarian who eventually emigrated to Australia. His name was Yul Brown, and he started to work on experimenting of electrolysis with water, and he found that he can produce a type of gaseous output from it. It was sort of a mixture of hydrogen, oxygen, and a type of combination of oxygen and hydrogen, which they called hydroxy, as well as other elements in this mixture. He started with water, but by applying electrolysis to it with certain very careful parameters, the right frequency, the right amount of current, there was much to be learned about how to do this, and it took Yul a number of years to get the bugs out of it. But by the mid-80s or so, he had, or I should say even the early 80s, he had done quite well in electrolyzing water, and he was able to produce a gas that initially he used for a source of welding gas. Now, normally, we're accustomed to welding gas being two bottles, typically one, a bottle of oxygen and a bottle of acetylene. Those gases are mixed, and the torch is lit, and you can use it as a cutting torch, or you can use it for welding. Well, Yul Brown was able to replace both the oxygen and the acetylene with just the output from his electrolyzer, which he called Brown's gas. Now, a guy named Christopher Bird, a very, very sharp author, he died a few years ago, but he wrote many wonderful books that have helped humanity. A few of them that come to mind are The Divining Hand, which is a wonderful book about dowsing. He wrote a book called something about the soil. He did it with another, I think, Peter Tompkins. Oh, Secrets of the Soil. And 5 or 6 or 10, Christopher Bird did a lot of wonderful books, a lot of great research. Christopher Bird met up with Yul Brown somewhere in the mid-80s. Once he discovered what Yul Brown had, they went around. Christopher Burr came from a wealthy Washington family, kind of an Eastern establishment family. So he had the ear and of many of the top corporate movers and shakers in America. And he bought Ewell Brown to every major corporate interest in this country. And Ewell Brown demonstrated it's possible to produce this fabulous gaseous substance called Brown's gas. You can use it for many things beyond welding. You can use it as a source of heat for a home. You could use it as a way to obtain electricity. You can use it for driving an automobile. It has unlimited applications. After years of going around to almost all of the top corporate officials in this country, they all said, this is extraordinary. I've never seen such a magnificent thing. This is wonderful. And what did they do? Nothing. They did absolutely nothing. Although they recognized the potential of it. Now, this greatly frustrated Ewell Brown, and Christopher Bird for that matter. So Ewell Brown went back to Australia. However, when he got back there, the Chinese ambassador came to visit him. The Chinese ambassador in Australia had heard about, was privy to the demonstrations, Ewell Brown, and they invited Ewell to come to China and to demonstrate, which he did.
Let me guess. They heard that from
I'm sorry?
that was just a joke.
Okay.
The Chinese heard about it from Bill Clinton, is what I was saying.
That's... There may be more truth to that than you might think. So what happened is that the Chinese invited him out to one of their larger research facilities, I guess in Beijing, and he did a demonstration for 30 or 40 Chinese scientists. They instantly recognized the value, and within hours he was on a plane to a research facility in Inner Mongolia, apparently. And they hired him to help teach their scientists how to use this. And they, after getting an introductory lecture from Ewell, within a matter of hours, he's in the research facility and he's starting to work with his now Chinese colleagues to teach him how to use this technology. While all the major corporations in America gave him a big hand at the end of the presentation for 2, 3, 4 years he was trying to interest corporate America in this, and they did nothing. The Chinese moved in a matter of hours. Now, what's the fallout? Today in China, and for many years since the early 90s when they first talked to Ewell Brown and got him to come over there to demonstrate his system, they have been, the Chinese now, have been running with this technology for about 16, 17 years. A large number of trains, locomobiles in China operate on Brown's gas. Mm-hmm. Many of the sea vessels that, those large container ships that bring all those Chinese trinkets into U.S. ports are arriving there. They operate under Brown's gas. There are millions of factories and households in China that are able to, you can, there's many advanced applications of Brown's gas. The Chinese, working with Ewell Brown, found out that you can charge what they call a brick. It's a type of material that can absorb a large amount of the Brown's gas and sort of condense it, and it doesn't. And then you could put this brick inside a chamber, and it releases the Brown's gas. So let's say you can heat your house for a month, and then what the Chinese homeowner does is he takes the brick back, pays the fee, they recharge it with Brown gas, and he takes it home, and then they get another month. So the Chinese have taken advantage of a technology that Ewell Brown and Christopher Bird essentially were pleading with corporate America to develop in the mid 80s, easily 7-8 years before the Chinese had the opportunity to even approach Yul Brynner on it, and corporate America turned him down flat. Why? Because corporate America knows what I know, and I've written about it on my website. There is an intentional agenda to destroy this country. And they don't want economic development in this country. That's why they've been working so hard since approximately the early 60s to drive out all heavy, medium, and light industry out of this country. Because they want to destroy America. Now, we, American citizens, need to understand the agenda of the elites. They're dedicated to destroying this country and its people and its wealth. So what we're going to do is we're going to come up with simple solutions to produce our own electricity, to run our cars with either very little gas or no gasoline. Now, look, we can apply. There are a number of people who, in many cases, almost simultaneously, have been working on very simple ways to produce Brown's gas. And one of them is a guy named Bill Lang. He's a fellow probably in his, probably mid-60s, I'm guessing. Lives in Florida, and he has a brother here in California. His name is Tom Lang. Well, Bill obtained a, Bill used to be involved in large-scale research projects. And before he retired. And he found out, a fellow bought a device to him many years ago that the Army used in tanks and airplanes in World War II. It was a very secret, hush-hush, device that had the effect of taking water and atomizing it in a very unique way and combining this extremely fine vapor of water with the vacuum of engines, of internal combustion engines that ran tanks, for instance, and ran airplanes. And we, the United States, and used this system in World War II. Now, one of the reasons that the British defeated Rommel at the Battle of El Alamein in North Africa during World War II is that Rommel's tanks ran out of gas before the British or American tanks did. The reason is that they had installed these secret devices, very simple devices, that when you atomize the water in the way I suggested, and it's drawn into the carburetor via the vacuum, it had an effect on the gasoline. It made the gasoline itself break down into smaller chains. It had the net effect of vaporizing the gasoline to a larger extent. Now, let me explain a very simple, basic point that needs to be understood about gasoline combustion. The finer, more mist-like the vapor of gasoline is, the more mileage you get out of a given drop of gas, and B, the more power you get out of the gas. So that a carburation system that exists in most of our cars are very inefficient in the fineness of the vaporization of the gas. They design them so that the vaporization just does the job, but without giving us enormous fuel economy, because they don't want us to have fuel economy. So what used to be, I remember in the cars in the 60s, 70s, 80s, big 350-liter cars, maybe you get 13, 14, 15 miles a gallon. And then we had the oil embargo of the 70s. So the Japanese cars picked up in popularity, and they could get in 25, 30, 35, depends, very small cars, maybe as high as 38 gallons a month. However, the manufacturers of all cars know how to make a far more efficient carburetor because they understand what Charles Pogue discovered in the late 20s and early 30s. The more fine you vaporize the gas, the greater the economy of the gas. Now, this fellow Bill Lang is on these a couple of these chat lists, which talk about using how to take advantage of water. Now, Bill Lang is not the only one doing this. There's a number of people doing this, and we won't have time to cover all the other people in this show, but we'll at least cover his program and maybe one other guy who's been working in this area. All the guys that I'm aware of who are working on this, they're all essentially developed systems that are variations of Brown's gas. So it's important to just learn about Brown's gas and just do a Google search under that name, and I'm sure many, many, many articles will come up.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about Bill Lang's unit. He figured out a simple way to sort of emulate in action what this World War II device was doing in the tanks that they were using, the Americans were using in North Africa, and also for our airplanes, by the way. This is another secret, if you will, of World War II that wasn't known until many decades after the war. The Japanese Air Force, when they still had their Air Force, were able to fly much higher and much faster than American planes could because they were using a fuel source that was much different than the one we were using. They were sort of using an ethanol-based fuel source that also took advantage of some of this technology that I'm alluding to. They got much greater power, and they got much more flight distance out of a given gallon of this fuel that they were using. Well, anyway, Bill had mentioned that he adopted this World War II device to an automobile, and it was quite easy to do. So he came up with a simple design that anyone could get a glass jar. You need to have a jar to produce your Brown's gas in, and a glass mason's jar, which is normally used for cannon, is a nice strong glass jar and it has a screw on top, etc. What he did is that he uses voltage from the battery. Now, the type of electrolysis we're talking about is from the 12-volt car battery. Now, some systems with some guys who are working on this idea will pulse the voltage with what are called pulse control modules. And that's another story. They have unique attributes to them. But Bill's system just uses straight DC voltage right from the battery, and he's using a couple stainless steel wires for the electrodes. And what he does is he takes a couple pieces of plexiglass that are overall rectangular in shape, and he cuts a notch out of each one so that he can fit one into the other, so at a right angle, if you can imagine this, so mm-hmm. that you would have these two rectangular pieces of plexiglass that could slide into each other and give you four walls, something like the four points of a compass, okay? And he simply uses that form to wind, he notches the edges, and he winds his stainless steel wire around that, okay? So you have some extended surface area. And then he takes this assembly and he puts it down in the mason glass jar. He puts water in it. He adds he adds some baking soda to the water. Now, there's a couple reasons for doing that. He wants to he wants to charge the water to make the water take an ionic charge. You know, in order for electricity to pass more easily through water, it needs an ionic charge. And you could do that with something as simple as salt, but he's using baking soda. He found that it's working better for him. So that will both alkalize the water and allow the electricity to flow through it. And he presents full instructions on how to do this on a website run by a man called Ozzy Freedom. Now, Ozzy Freedom received his information from Bill Lang, and he's put together a booklet, a DVD. He's got kits that he'll sell to people in which you can get the jar and the wire and the whole nine yards from him, and I don't think he's charging too much money. But the information of how to make your own is contained within the book, as well as there's many articles and pictures on this website run by Ozzy Freedom. And the name of the website, you can write this down, is waterforgas.com. Four is the numeral four. So water, numeral four, gas.com. And when you go to that site, you'll see tons of pictures and lots of explanations, and eventually you'll find where you can find the book and read the testimonials of many people. On average, Bill Lang says you can expect about certainly a 35% increase in fuel economy using his system, but some people, like his brother Tom, was able to achieve a 50% increase in fuel economy, but other people have achieved as much as 100% increase in fuel economy.
Now, I have a question, Ken. Mm-hmm. How often must one replace the water?
Well, thank you for bringing it up. I forgot to mention it. There are so many wonderful facts to learn about Brown's gas. This is going to kill you. It hardly uses up any of the water. Now, this is hard to believe, I understand. This Brown's gas is a unique soup. There is so much densification of this energy within the water molecule that once it's released, there's an amplification factor of, somebody told me the number, but it's in the millions. So one molecule of water, when it releases at Brown's gas, is amplified by a million times or 2 million times. So you might have to replenish the water, what, maybe once a month? We're talking about a mason canning jar. How much water could that take? A couple pints?
Well, it depends on the size of the jar, I guess.
Right, okay, but it hardly takes any of the water. So this is a system that is producing this unusual soup of gases, a mixture of gases. There's probably six or seven different gases that come out of this electrolysis process. And it's drawn into the carburetor system via the vacuum lines. And the instructions in the book and on Ozzy Freedom's website shows you pictures. There's plenty of graphs. There's videos on YouTube that explain this. There's videos linked to Ozzy Freedom's website that explain this. Anybody can do this in a couple of hours. The parts for the canning jar, for some rubber tubing, for some simple T-fittings, the stainless steel wire, the plexiglass, how much is that going to cost you? 15, 20 bucks, maybe? Any basic do-it-yourself guy can put this together simply. If you want to buy a finished kit, which is simple in itself, Ozzy Freedom provides you with what you need. I just want people to know that the Bill Lang device is just one of easily 15 different variations on Brown's gas that I've become aware of in the last few years that a child could do.
And now, I have a question. Mm-hmm. I've got one more question about the coil. You were describing it, and I was trying to picture these notches. I would presume that depending on how much, depending on the length of the coil or the wire that you have to wrap around the plexiglass.
Yeah, the perimeter of the plexiglass that you've sort of made into the shape of a, two rectangular pieces that intersect each other at right angles.
Yes. Is it operating as an amplifier or as a choke, if you get my meaning? In other words, you can use a coil, let's say.
I understand. Let me explain. There is no usage of, I just described the word coil, meaning it goes circularly around the length of the plexiglass holder. It has no electrical functions in terms of electronics. It's not a choke. It's not acting as an inductor. No, I didn't mean it that way.
It's just a
conduit. It's the way to get a lot of wire in the jar, and so the wire doesn't touch itself.
You're trying
to increase the surface area for purposes of electrolysis.
Okay.
So if we just stuck straight wires into the bottom of the jar, we can only get 5 inches or 4 inches in water. But when we loop it, now we can get 20 or 25 inches of wire. The increased surface area increases the total amount of electrolysis.
Yeah, that was the nature of my question. So thanks for explaining that.
Right. So I'm glad you made that clear. Right.
One of us had to, right?
Right. The wire that you're using is stainless steel. Why? Because in this electrolysis process, when you have a alkaline solution, which is what you get with water and baking soda, if we use other types of wires, they would corrode pretty fast. But stainless steel lasts the longest. It will still corrode in time, and you'll have to replace it. But that's the reason that they're using stainless steel. In fact, Bill recommends a particular grade of stainless steel, and I forget the number. It might be 304 stainless. But all that detail, those details are in the book that's available on Ozzy Freedom's website. Now, I can't recall. The book may be I'm guessing at this. I can't remember. But the book may be a free download as a PDF. That's entirely possible.
Mm.
So you might even be able to get all the data, not even have to spend a dime.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. Now, has anyone tried, let's say, like gold wire or something maybe plated with platinum or...
I'll tell you, you won't find that at Ozzy Freedom's site, but other researchers who've looked into this and have developed, let's say, more sophisticated Brown's gas systems have used other electrode material. Platinum particularly has shown great promise. There's much more to this, a whole game of using water as fuel than this brief outline of Bill Lang's a device, but what I like about Bill Lang is that he wanted to keep it simple so the average Joe can do this and doesn't have to get into a lot of money and a lot of sophisticated laboratory equipment and so forth. So there are other systems we can talk about in other shows that use just water for the fuel, nothing else. But it requires much more equipment. Now, the second guy I've got to mention, there's many great guys who are doing this work. In fact, let me mention two more. There's a guy named George Wiseman who has an outfit called Eagle Research. And I guess the website is eagleresearch.com, but I'm not sure. So people should go to a Google search and put in the name George Wiseman plus Eagle Research, and they will come to his website. Now, he's got a ton of devices you can buy from him for both carbureted cars and for fuel-injected cars, and he also has books that explain his own development of this Brown's gas or hydroxy gas. There's many names for Brown's gas. He's got a lot of great info on his website. So now, the third guy, who probably has a website, I don't know, but I know his name, and this guy's just got wonderful many years of research on how to use alternative fuels, both water as well as ethanol. Is a guy named Phil Ratte, R-A-T-T-E. And he's got fabulous info. I believe he has two or three books. I got to mention one more man's name. I don't have the website, but do a search under his name. He has fabulous research book and data. His name is Brad Dennis. Brad Dennis. So now we've given you four names. Bill Lang's info about the very simple brown gas producing hydrolyzer unit can be found at Aussie Freedom's website. And that URL is water4gas.com. Three other people I mentioned was, the last name was Brad Dennis. Do a research. Brad Dennis and plus perhaps fuel economy.
Yes. Then, now, I'd like to emphasize something here, too, because there are some people out there that are claiming to have these same results, and they may to some extent, but the amount of money people are going to invest is sort of hidden in that particular product. For instance, there are gas additives, $25 a bottle. So you're looking at a quarter of a tank of gas per full tank of gas to add this to your gasoline. And they're proclaiming that these additives are doing the same things that these electrolytic converters are doing. And I would just like to stress that there is a big difference between the two. In fact, you're talking about a minimal expense here.
Yes.
And a minimal amount of effort. It's just using a scientific principle to our advantage.
Right. All right. I'll briefly explain those additives and those pellets. What they do is they chemically break down the chains or further break down the chains of the gasoline molecule to make it a shorter chain. Mm-hmm. And that's why they get the economy over time. But if you have to pay a lot for them, it's not worth it. The device we're talking about, this simple Brown's gas hydrolyzer, achieves the same purpose on demand directly into the carburetor, and the only thing you're paying for is the water that's going in the jar. So this is a much simpler system to use, obviously less costly, much more effective. Brown's gas does a much greater job than those pellets. Those pellets, under the best of circumstances, get 10, 15, maybe 20%. With Brown's gas, with Bill Lang's system, you're starting out, he'll tell you, you can probably expect a 35% increase in gas mileage. Now you can take this farther. Bill Lang found that adding hydrogen peroxide can extend this action tremendously. There's a lot more to this research than I'm giving a brief overview, but the point of this was just to get the listener who had no idea that you can use water as a fuel to run a car. You need to become aware that there's multiple variations on Brown's gas, and for people who are in the know, savvy about the websites and the researchers, a lot of guys are putting these devices in their cars. Yes, some people are trying to make money out of it. There's some outfit, is it in Canada, I believe, that are charging beaucoup, really big bucks for a hydrolyzer, thousands and thousands of dollars. There was a guy in Massachusetts who developed a system based on something that was freely made available over the internet by a nice young man who was, you know, making his DVD available for $20. A company in Massachusetts that used to do engines for speedboats and so forth developed a system based on this young man's information, and they quickly got an offer that went to something like, I don't know, $60 million to buy it up, to hush up the information. They're not going to hush this information up. They can They can pay anyone they want $60 million. This information is freely available on the Internet, and anybody can learn to make a Brown's gas hydrolyzer.
Hmm.
Now, how much time do we have left?
Well, we're just about out of time here.
Okay.
Do you want to recap anything, or
I just didn't want to run over. We can leave it at where we put it. We will do other shows in which I can go into greater depth of other developers of variations on Brown's gas. We can talk about Yul Brown himself. There's a huge and wonderful story there. We can talk about what the Chinese are doing. And we could also mention that, you know, one of the deals that the controllers of the world made is that they told the Chinese, well, okay, you can produce these things, but you can't make them available to citizens of the United States or Europe. How do you like them bananas?
Yeah, well, it makes sense for the Chinese to have them because they have such a wonderful standard of living. They wouldn't be able to afford gasoline, without that type of technology,
right,
saving them money. So they work on both ends. You know, it's like you described. They have various methods of acquiring power to run their household appliances. And if it's only once a month, I'm sure it's far less money than what we pay
for. Oh, it's far less money because at the time when Yul Brown first was making these available, this was before the Chinese, you know, growth boom had taken place, and, you know, an average, let's say, man who was, let's say, in the business of, repair shop welding, his total yearly income was like $200 or $300. And so they were able to buy a Brown's gas generator for, you know, perhaps the equivalent of $25 or $30 or $50.
Mm.
And then they had free energy from then on out. All they had to do was fill it with water. He can do all the welding. He can heat his house. They can heat people. This is a story that needs to be exposed big time.
And no free lunch, right?
Well,
let's not go to lunch, in other words.
Yes, you know what I'm saying? Right.
Or no lunchtime dinners.
So we want to point out, as you started the show, is that American oil companies are hoarding vast supplies of oil in Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, under Gulls Island. Lindsey Williams was present at the time they discovered that find. They said there is enough oil there to meet all the energy needs of the United States for the next 200 years. There are other places around the American continent that the oil company is sitting on vast oil reserves. They do not want the American public to know about it. There's oil reserves in Vietnam, in the Saigon Bay. There's many hidden oil reserves. They just announced on NPR radio a few days ago they found a large amount of oil in Brazil. There's a lot amount of oil everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
The oil crisis is completely contrived in every sense of the word. By the way, the last thing, let's mention this. Oil does not come from decaying fossil corpses.
From decaying politicians.
Right. Oil is produced by the earth. There's a specific process in which certain bacteria that live at a certain deep level under the earth can act on certain chemical compounds and produce what we call oil. There are many wells that, quote, ran dry during their earlier periods and were no longer in use, and the oil companies found out 5 or 10 years later that those wells filled up with oil again.
Mm-hmm.
The public doesn't know that.
the Earth has the capacity or the ability to replenish the oil.
Correct. Now, I'm not in favor of pulling oil out of the ground because oil should be left in the ground.
I agree.
But, nevertheless, oil is a Earth renewable resource. It is not, never has been, a fossil fuel. It's not the carcasses of dinosaurs. In Russia, they have oil wells that go 12 miles deep. Anyone who understands where dinosaur fossils are found, they're not 12 miles under the Earth, under the surface of the Earth, nowhere near it. All oil is produced by what they call the abiotic, non-fossil process. So, I think we at least covered the main points, that we can be energy free, but we have to do the work ourselves. The government isn't going to take care of us. The oil companies aren't going to take care of us. We can take care of ourselves. We don't need their stinking oil.
That's right. And that's why we have Evident Footprints, is to bring this information out to the public and give them some solutions as well. Well, Ken, it has been fascinating, very informative. You certainly know your stuff, as I stated in the beginning. And we're going to have you back again. We'll have to figure out when we can get you worked into the schedule this month. There are some openings, so you know I want to have you back, and we can talk about the applications that are available to us in other areas as well. You know, it was going through my mind how many people have been stranded on a lake or a river or at sea running out of fuel, and this would be a fantastic solution to the fuel problems that boaters go through.
Yeah.
Pleasure boaters and fishermen.
Oh, yes. And they could be. Well, there was a man who did that. There was In the early 70s, there was a man who was doing just that. He was demonstrating a water fuel engine that he put in a boat on the boat. He was running around a lake, and he said to the reporters, "I'm running on my fuel tank." And he meant that he's riding on the water. The water of the lake was the fuel that fed the engine.
Mm-hmm.
And Andrei Poharich, who has been dead a few years, but he's a famous doctor scientist. He developed a water fuel motorhome. He developed an engine that ran on water as a fuel. I should have said. And when he ran out of when he ran out of water, when he was traveling through Mexico. He was up in the mountains, I think the Sonora Mountains. He simply gathered up some snow and stuffed it down into, the opening that he normally puts the water in, and was just hoping and praying that the snow melted enough so he could start up his engine again and get out of there, and he did. And in another case, he actually got the water. He was in a desert environment once, and he ran out, and he got the water from cactus. He used cactus water. And he was able to. I mean, there's an amazing story there of Poharich. There's a lot of amazing stories about people who can run internal combustion engines on water.
Now, if you're in that situation where there's no snow and no cactus, there's only one solution left.
There's another source of water. That's right.
Yeah, let's hope we never have to use that one.
But
right?
It could be done. It could be done.
Yes.
And remember, it doesn't take much.
Yes.
Take much.
Okay. Well, Ken, it's been fascinating, and we'll have you back on the show again soon. And I want to, again, remind everyone, visit Ken's website and visit it often, educate-yourself.org or educate-yourself.org, or however you prefer that little mark in between the two words. Ken, thanks so much. I'm looking forward to having you back again soon. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. Our special guest tonight was Mr. Ken Adachi, Visit his site again, educate-yourself.org. My name is Don Nikoloff, and my website is directlightproductions.com. There's lots there for you to see. Got some new animal videos that'll kind of crack you up, too, on the animals page. So, in the meantime, join us tomorrow night. Our special guest will be Mr. Wynn Free. We're going to be talking about the Council of the Elohim. And on Friday night, scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher Jim Murray, my regular Friday guest, will be with us once again. In the meantime, peace, love, and light. And everyone, have a good night.